Welcome to episode 5 of The Short Way Home. I'm your host, Michael Chin. This podcast is released in conjunction with my new book, The Long Way Home, from Cowboy Jamboree Press. Cowboy Jamboree Press, good grit lit, home to other titles including Adam Van Winkle's novella, Hard Way Juice. Thanks to Adam Van Winkle specifically for the art for the book cover and this podcast's artwork. In this episode, I'm focusing on Cactus Jack versus Big Van Vader in a Texas death match they had at WCW Halloween Havoc 1993. So this match was set off of an angle between Cactus Jack and Vader. It started at a WCW Saturday night show. So that used to be kind of the flagship show for WCW in the days before they launched Nitro and the whole Monday Night War. It was a lot of squash matches, but also would tend to have at least one competitive match at or around the main event spot. It was a particularly brutal match, that original one from Saturday night. And it included, you know, Cactus Jack pulling the upset victory off of Vader, who had come across as pretty unbeatable at that point. And then afterwards, Vader hits him with a power bomb on the cement floor, which is an especially brutal spot for that era. I think in any era, that's a pretty convincing one. Vader was known for being stiff, and he's, you know, a good 400-pound guy. And so, you know, anything he did stiffly looked like it really would hurt. And of course, Cactus Jack, you know, now better known as Mick Foley, his real name, you know, was able to sell this stuff great, and, you know, very willing to take the hard hit. So the whole thing came off beautifully. And then it looked like it was obviously going to be the setup for a further feud because, you know, Jack had pulled off a rare victory over Vader. Vader had gone on to, you know, deliver that powerbomb on the floor, which would, you know, set up an injury angle. And so every logical sign points to, okay, they're setting up to revisit this issue and that, you know, they'll continue in, you know, comparably brutal fashion, which they did ultimately do, but they took on the long way around to get there. So basically, it was set up a pretty convoluted and kind of silly amnesia angle where Cactus Jack went missing and they found him in Cleveland and, you know, hanging out where he'd kind of forgotten who he was and I think was living among homeless people there and, you know, was kind of in poor taste and was very silly, you know, and sort of felt kind of, you know, of the cartoonish ilk of the stuff that WWE had been doing in the years leading up to that, but not really as well executed. You know, being generous with it, I think the, you could view it as, you know, ambitious in its scope of storytelling and trying to, you know, do something really different. And they did ultimately tie it around to suggest that all the amnesia stuff was just a mind game that Cactus Jack was playing to kind of throw Vader off his scent before he did come back for revenge. You know, and if you're going to kind of interrogate that storyline, it doesn't hold up that well, because he just sort of is missing for, you know, a good month or two or whatever it is. And then when he comes back, you know, fights through other guys, who Harley Race is managing in addition to Vader, most notably, Yoshi Kwan, and it sets up eventually him, you know, having his big blow off with Vader. So the two of them, you know, go into it for the Halloween Havoc pay-per-view in the main event spot with the world title on the line. And I appreciate that they did bring it back around to brutality with a Texas death match, which we'll get into in a moment here. But part of the fun of this thing is that WCW had a gimmick at that time for the Halloween Havoc pay-per-view that it's funny for my younger days. I remember this being, you know, a big annual thing that they would just, you know, revisit and revisit. And, you know, I only remember two instances of it, you know, concretely. And when I was researching it, it seems that really there were only two instances of it. But the tradition I'm talking about is the spin the wheel, make the deal match. So the concept of this is that there are a bunch of different kinds of gimmick matches, like a steel cage match and, you know, a false count anywhere match and all this different stuff listed on a Wheel of Fortune style wheel that someone comes out and spins, and then we settle on a particular match type, and so neither guy can really prepare for it. It kind of implies, you know, some level of chaos. So the first time they did this was Halloween Havoc 1992, and it led to Sting and Jake Roberts blowing off their issue in a coal miner's glove match, which is kind of notorious for just being about the most mundane match type they could settle on, just a coal miner's glove on a pole, which is just sort of an anticlimactic gimmick and sort of old-fashioned and silly. And so there's a lot of rumor that they actually had not gimmicked the wheel, that they were just kind of settled on luck of the draw and then got unlucky, which seems, you know, like a pretty foolish concept. But the general consensus since then has been, know that they did gimmick the wheel. They did know what kind of match they were getting into, and they just didn't plan something all that exciting. So with that, I will say, you know, spin the wheel, make the deal, sort of silly and sort of overly gimmicked, you can argue, in terms of, they list a cage match on there. There's no cage hanging over the ring. So it's pretty obvious it's not actually going to be a cage match. And then beyond that, they're relying on the mystery to draw pay-per-view buyers in that case. So, if you want to advertise a appealing gimmick match, that's one thing. But if you want to advertise that it could be any kind of match that appeals to, a certain subset of fans, I thought it was a cool gimmick, especially at the time. But also, it doesn't promise anything. It could be really anticlimactic. And especially because the first iteration was, it does kind of invite some degree of doubt and skepticism around that. But this is a concept WWE would actually revisit years later when Eric Bischoff was cast as the general manager of Raw, and he hosted a bunch of Raw Roulette episodes of Raw when they were in Las Vegas, which was a fun spin on the concept, because it was kind of a throwback to, Bischoff's connection to WCW. It was kind of an organic tie-in to shows happening in Vegas. And I don't think it was quite the campy fun that Spin the Wheel, Make the Deal was, but actually it probably made more sense, in that, more updated, sophisticated kind of product. But getting back to the match itself, they spin the wheel, it lands on Texas Deathmatch. This is pretty much a perfect gimmick for the two of them. So, the rules of a Texas Deathmatch, at least as it was executed in this particular outing, are that, it's falls count anywhere, you have to pin somebody, but then after they've been pinned, they have to stay down for a count of 10. And that's how someone wins the match. So it's basically a slightly modified version of what WWE now markets as a last man standing match, where someone has to answer the count of 10, falls count anywhere. They just added that to be pinned first. It's a suitable kind of blow off concept. The idea that, there's not going to be any rules. These guys can use any kind of weaponry, any maneuvers they want. And then ultimately, it's not just about stealing a pin or getting lucky and locking in a submission hold, but, having to actually, incapacitate someone so they can't answer the count of 10 after being pinned. And they delivered on it. It's a hard hitting brawl. And especially for that era, this is a time when, national wrestling is not known for being especially rough. WCW, I would contend, was better at this style than the WWE, more willing to go with some actual violence and, hard hitting offense and all of that. But this one in particular, I think, kind of pushed the boundaries of that and was a lot rougher than anything else WCW was doing at the time, much less anything WWE was doing at the time. And kind of, you could argue that there's some allusion to the appeal that ECW was just starting to pick up, around this time, as kind of a hot indie, because they focus on that more hardcore style. It's a little early to say that they really influenced WCW in a meaningful way here, but it might just be kind of that was sort of the ethos of the time. Everything was kind of leaning towards this more over-the-top violence and all that. But this is a match, I was already kind of compelled to Vader. I was always kind of into the big monster heels. And I'd say, he was a monster heel who could actually work. Just a few months before this, he hit his first, top rope moonsault, in a tag team match main event, at the Beach Blast show. So he had proven he had the athleticism. His stuff looked great. He really was, trying to hurt people. And some would argue that his shortfall, as a worker in this era was that he was too stiff, that he actually did hurt people. But regardless, he was so compelling, in that bully villain kind of role. And then in terms of, you know, Cactus Jack, I would say this is the match that really made me a big fan of Mick Foley in the first place. He'd go on to become a lot more famous as Mankind and Dude Love and you're reprising the Cactus Jack role in WWE. But this is where he kind of got a big main event break in WCW. He had worked a program with Sting prior to this where he was the heel and just kind of playing, you know, the crazed villain, which was kind of an interesting spin on the monster heel and the kind of opponents that were being pitched against Sting at that time. But in this particular setting, casting him as a madman face, I think was in some ways you know, more compelling. It was a different dynamic than most of Vader's rivals in that era. He had a lot of, you know, really good matches with Sting. He had a rivalry with Ron Simmons, one with Davey Boy Smith. And, you know, with all of those programs, the narrative was basically, you know, Vader's an overwhelming monster and he's up against these guys who are, you know, big and powerful enough to hang in there with him, but also, you know, fast and athletic enough to throw stuff at him where, you know, they just might be able to steal the win. And Vader really faced a different kind of challenge with Cactus Jack, where it wasn't so much that he was, you know, strong or that he was athletic so much as that he was just kind of nuts, right? That he would just throw any kind of offense, absorb any level of punishment and keep coming after Vader, which I think made for a really fun storyline. And in many ways may have paved the road for, you know, the legacy that Foley would build. You know, he was kind of underappreciated in WCW. I think it's pretty fair to say this is about as high as he got. With that company, after this story, he would mostly be demoted to the tag team ranks, working with Kevin Sullivan and Max Payne. Before ultimately leaving the company and then, you know, going on to ECW, which set up his WWE run, and, you know, kind of the rest is history from there. But with this, you know, particular match at Halloween Havoc 1993, the only real knock that I would suggest is the finish. You know, and it's something that Eric Bischoff has talked about on the 83 Weeks podcast, that WCW just never really had anyone, you know, kind of working in an agent kind of role, helping to plan matches, who really knew how to book a compelling finish, at least on any kind of consistent basis. You know, and it kind of reeks of, with the way this one finished, that they were trying to, you know, not only keep the title on Vader and allow him to move on from this program, but also sort of protect Mick Foley and Cactus Jack in this setting. So the way it ends is that Vader's manager, Harley Race, you get him with a stun gun in the leg that means he's, you know, knocked down and then, you know, physically just isn't able to get up to answer the 10 count. You know, which is smart enough, I guess, as a, you know, workaround, and so that it's not like Foley's actually getting, you know, beaten until he's, you know, not able to answer it or doesn't want to, you know, get up anymore. But it's also just kind of a cheap way out, right? Because if Vader had just, you know, hit him with another power bomb on the floor, or, you know, hit him with a couple of Vader bombs in the corner, that really could have, I would argue, put him over better as an unbeatable monster. You know, still no real shame on Foley, but especially if Foley was going to be demoted to, you know, the mid card and the tag team ranks, it sort of didn't matter, right? At that point, he doesn't really need to be protected as a main event guy because WCW wasn't going to use him in that capacity, anyway, at that point. But anyway, this match, it really captured my imagination. I, you know, and even the whole storyline, as cheesy as the amnesia angle was, you know, I enjoyed it for what it was in that era. And, you know, again, keeping in mind that I'm, you know, whatever, just turned like 10 years old or so, around this time. So my, you know, level of scrutiny was not as high as it might've been later on in life. But I would say, you know, this match in particular, what was huge in kind of tipping the scales for me to really be a WCW fan. You know, I'd been tempted by WCW before. I was sort of interested in their products because I liked basically any professional wrestling I could get my eyes on in that era. But I was so kind of compelled with all this that it kind of convinced me for the first time WCW was better than WWE. That level of fanship kind of continued until Hulk Hogan came to WCW and they sort of shifted gears and became more of a you know, sort of a reprise of what WWE had been in the 1980s. And then I sort of, you know, was more neutral or leaning towards WWE again. You know, the Dungeon of Doom kind of came up around that era and was sort of the definitive heel stable, which were just a bunch of kind of, you know, goons for Hulk Hogan to beat up on, only for the New World Order angle to, you know, turn me back around and, you know, come to WCW for a longer stretch there. But in any event, you know, one of my favorite matches of all time, I wholeheartedly recommend it to anyone, with access to WWE Network. I think you can still catch, you know, at least highlights from it on YouTube as well. So it's a fun match to see. But okay, so in relation to, you know, I spent most of this episode talking about a Texas Death match and, you know, maybe the most kind of watched one, you know, not because, WCW was at its peak in this era, but because, it was a rare case of a match with that particular gimmick title, at least being, you know, marketed that heavily and, you know, put in a national pay-per-view spot, in the main event. So, you know, based on that, with that Texas Death match in our rearview mirror, I'm going to go ahead and read a piece from The Long Way Home, called Texas Death. This is a flash piece from the Autopsy and Everything After section of the book. Texas Death. In the Texas Death match, there are no holds barred, and the wrestling, the fighting, need not remain in the ring. Foreign objects are legal, no submission, no surrender. A simple pin even won't win the match, but rather a pin followed by a referee's 10 count. So we brawled, me and New York Nick Nettles, from the ring to ringside, out into the audience, up the stairs, to let everyone feel a piece of the action. People are used to TV these days, with cameras that follow the action so everyone can see what's happening at any given moment. We have no cameras, no big screens to work with, and depended on the noise and the energy pulsing through different sections of the arena when the fans couldn't even see us. And we brawled through the doors, out of anyone's sight, a half hour in. We couldn't stay out of view long, but it was a chance for a breath. We each sat down for a minute before New York pointed out the water fountain behind me. He got the first sip, while I waited behind him like a child at school, thirsty and impatient. But the fountain didn't work. We banged on the sides of the fountain, tried to depress the lever further and make water come forth, but soon enough it was clear the thing just didn't work. And as we cursed and kicked at it, I spotted the boy. This boy, alone, probably 8 or 9 years old, bright blonde hair, a button-up shirt. He watched us, wide-eyed, keeping his distance at first before he stepped forward and offered me his clear plastic 20-ounce bottle of Mountain Fresh spring water. I drank greedily, downed half the bottle in a gulp before I passed it to New York. He took a more measured sip, then looked at the kid, looked at him like the meanest heel he was supposed to be, and took what was left of the bottle, whipped it against the brick wall so water sprayed loose, so the sound of plastic against the wall popped as he started throwing wild right-hand punches at my head. The kid screamed and retreated. These wrestlers were real. We battled back out in front of the crowd. The kid was nowhere to be seen. I drilled New York with a crescent kick to the jaw, then pointed to no one in particular, and lifted New York for the brainbuster down the staircase back toward the arena floor, where I pinned him, where he stayed down and as still as a dead man, shot down in a gunfight in the heart of Texas. Okay, so that was Texas Death, originally published in Metonym, and now in my new book, The Long Way Home. So thanks for listening. The Long Way Home is available from Cowboy Jamboree Press, distributed through Amazon. Follow me on Twitter @MikeTChin, or visit MikeTChin.com for more details.